All right, so I thought we'd go into an Old Testament lesson here tonight, and we're going to actually start in Luke chapter 17, part of the reading that we had here. Just want to re-emphasize a few things. And this lesson, if you were here this morning, then you're going to find that this lesson is drawing a lot of the same conclusions that we did this morning. It's just coming at it from a completely different angle, and sometimes that's very helpful to do that. All right, so in Luke chapter 17, verse 20 and following that was read, just as in Mark chapter 13 and Matthew chapter 24, Jesus is talking about this day of the Son of Man. And really what that refers to is a divine visitation for the purpose of judgment, and specifically referring to the end of Jerusalem. And by implication, necessary implication, the end of the Jewish nation. And by extension, or in principle, the end of the world. I don't believe he's talking about the end of the world here, but I'm saying that some of the principles or some of the characteristics that he is talking about regarding Jerusalem, regarding the Jewish state there, certainly do apply in principle there, and we can see that. So chapter 17, verse 28, it says, as it happened in the days of Lot, they were eating, they were drinking, they were buying, they were selling, they were planting, they were building. In other words, life is just going on just as usual. It's just another day. There's nothing extraordinary about the day, nothing that seems too alarming at all, and nothing that's getting these people's attention, despite the fact that they are very wicked people, as we'll find out. Nonetheless, they are immersed in the everyday details of their lives. But, verse 29, on the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. It will be just the same way on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. And on that day, one is not to go into the housetop and collect his belongings. One who is in the field and sees what is happening is not to go back into town. You can see this, and there's a curious allusion here to Sodom and Gomorrah, the account there in Genesis 19, which we'll get to in just a moment here. So we have this group of cities that are destroyed also by divine judgment. Jesus is talking about Jerusalem. And he's saying it will be in the destruction of Jerusalem, very similar to what you already know about in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. He's saying that in essence there. He's using one thing to describe or to bring attention to the other. There's not going to be time to prepare or time to escape if you're not paying attention. There won't be time to run. And people will be so caught up in their lives of sin and vice that they just won't see it coming. But the only ones who will see it coming will be those who saw it from a distance, so to speak, and got out of there while there was still time. In Luke chapter 17, verse 32, Jesus then says, very succinctly, says, remember Lot's wife. Here's a woman who has no name. She's kind of like the rich man and Lazarus there in Luke 16. And this indicates no special or lasting relationship with God. She's just another human being, sadly, not worthy of being remembered of anything beyond this. Isn't that just a sad thing? She's just Lot's wife. Doesn't even have a personalization to her account there. And likewise, if you think about it, and we'll be thinking about this in our spring meeting here, hell itself will be filled with nameless, faceless, identityless former human beings who, once they are there, will be only an empty shell of what they used to be, and even more frightening, what they could have been. And I find that very disturbing, very frightening in itself, that all those people that are consigned to that place, that life, that existence there, are going to be people, in essence, that will be forgotten. People that history will forget, people that those who are saved will forget, people that, in essence, are forgotten people. And Jesus is drawing attention to Lot's wife because she illustrates the same godless spirit as that which is found in the city which she just escaped from, Sodom and Gomorrah. Even though she was given opportunity to escape, she chose to look back and did so to her own destruction. Likewise, Jesus' countrymen, the Jews, were given opportunity to escape Jerusalem and that destruction and enter into the kingdom of God, but many of them clung instead to their Jewish heritage, to their tradition, to their old ways of thinking and doing things, and they missed the opportunity that they had. That's just a frightening thing, to think that people would cling to the things of this world so tightly that they would miss out on this, on the redemption that God provides for them. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, likewise, God has granted to us, quote, granted to Christians, his precious and magnificent promises, so that by them you may become partakers of the divine nature, and key in on this, having escaped the corruption that is in the world by lust. That's what it says in that passage there. And we have escaped that corruption. We have escaped the city, if you will. We have escaped that destruction, but only, again, if we learn the lesson of Lot's wife. All right, so I want to talk just briefly, very briefly, for our lesson's sake, for the time that we have here. In Genesis chapter 10, verse 19, we find that Sodom and Gomorrah is first mentioned there. And so it is, or they are, among the most ancient cities in recorded history. They're one of five cities in the valley. And the valley refers to that valley where present-day Dead Sea exists. For a long time, people thought that Sodom and Gomorrah were down in the south of the valley. I think there's good evidence to show that it's probably in the north. Regardless, the Hebrew word for the valley there really refers to the circle. There, it seems to me that there was a circle or encircling of those cities there in the valley, situated near the Dead Sea. And that area at the time was lush, it was green, it was fertile, very much unlike what it is today. The Dead Sea isn't called the Dead Sea for nothing. It is a dead sea. It is a dead place. It's not a place that is flowing with milk and honey like it is described in Scripture. It has just been ravaged by time, by war, by human overtaking, by all kinds of judgments of God. There's just been so much that has happened in that place in the last, really, 3,000 to 4,000 years there. It is known then as the cities of the valley, and you see the cities named there. Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim, and Zoar are those cities there. We're told in Genesis 13 that Abraham and Lot are on the west side of the Jordan River there, the west side of the Dead Sea area as we know it now. And they're in the land of Canaan, and there's so much of their flocks and herds that they're overgrazing and they're fighting amongst themselves. That is, their herdsmen and their shepherds are fighting among themselves for domain and territory and so on. So they need to split up. So Abraham says, you go one way, I'll go the other. And leaves it to Lot to decide which way he wants to go. Gives Lot first pick, in other words. And Lot chooses to go toward the valley of Sodom and Gomorrah. It says in that account that it was well watered like the garden of the Lord, referring to Eden. It was that good. It was like paradise on earth. And it was attractive, it was enticing, and it was tempting. A land itself like paradise, and yet the people of Sodom and Gomorrah were ungodly. They were demonic in nature. Their moral sins corrupted even that very Eden-like area there. And so we can see, I think it's safe to say at this point, that Lot's judgment was clouded by that, very much like wine, as the Bible talks about wine. You know, there is that sparkle, there's that buzz, and then there's that bite, okay? And that's really what happened here. He saw that, he was tempted, he was drawn in, but he didn't recognize what it was going to do to him in the process there. It's in Genesis 13, verse 13. We've covered all this very recently in our Wednesday night Genesis class, so this should be just a review for some of you. It says that the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. And Lot's compromise would have a negative reverberating effect on himself and his family's future for centuries. And in all fairness, since we are talking about Lot's wife, in all fairness, we don't see that she had any say in the decision. This was a decision that Lot made, but that affected her. In other words, she didn't necessarily agree with it, nor was she asked. We have no indication anyway. But she was most certainly affected by it and was still morally responsible for what she did. We're not trying to excuse her actions. We're just simply saying when it all started, this was the circumstance in which she found herself. Okay? And in Genesis chapter 18, verse 20, God says the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and in essence pronounces a destruction upon those people there at that time. Their sin is exceedingly grave, he says, and thus it is a city that is simply not worth saving. If you think about it, we used kind of a house analogy this morning. Here's another house analogy. Suppose you've got a house and it's got a little bit of damage to it, maybe termite or carpenter ant damage, and there's just a little bit of things here, maybe some sheetrock that's got a hole in it here and there. The whole house as a whole is good. The structure is sound. The foundation is solid. It's just got a few cosmetic repairs. Well, that's one scenario. But now imagine a house where the foundation is cracked. The whole place is shifting. I've seen houses like this. You probably have too. Maybe you've lived in it for all I know. Okay. We see these houses that are just, the floor is uneven. The roof is just a disaster. The walls are filled with mold or filled with bugs and everything else. And it's just, you're looking at these two places. Here's two houses that need attention. One just needs some cosmetic dressing up. The other one needs to be leveled and started over. Okay. And I think that's really what we're looking at. When he says that the city is wicked and exceedingly grave, we're not looking at a house with some cosmetic problems. We're looking at a house that the foundation is cracked, the roof is gone, the bugs are there, it is rotted to the core, it is ripe for destruction. It's not worth saving. And this is the point where Abraham tries to intercede and says, well, Lord, what if there was 50 righteous men? And God says, well, if there were 50, I wouldn't destroy the place. Well, what about 45? Well, what about 40 or 30 or 20 or even 10? If there were 10 righteous people, what would you do? And God says, I wouldn't destroy it if you could find 10 righteous people. And isn't it amazing that Abraham, who probably had a good knowledge of that city because of proximity, if nothing else, and his son Lot being there, he could not know of 10 righteous people in the city that would have saved all of this from happening. And in Genesis 19, the angels came and stayed with Lot. There's these two angels that come. You can read the account for yourself. And the men of Sodom and Gomorrah are not interested in showing kindness and hospitality. In fact, in chapter 19, verse 4 and 5, it says, before they lay down, that is, Lot and the angels that are staying at his house, before everyone settles down for the night, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. And they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them. And that's a euphemistic phrase for our audience that I don't need to interpret, okay? So the entire city is engulfed in the most filthy and deplorable acts. Men wanting to rape men is really what is going on here. We see this judgment of God against this city is most certainly deserved. Romans chapter 1, verse 28, Paul mentions there that such vice is the result of a depraved mind, since they did not acknowledge God any longer. When people turn away from God, bad things happen. And it doesn't just get a little bit bad and stay there. It keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse. It starts descending downward very quickly. In Jude verse 7, it says that the men of Sodom and Gomorrah indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh. In other words, referring to their forbidden acts that are brought on by wicked thoughts and the perversion of the mind. And shall we say, homosexuality will forever be equated with this occasion, because the word sodomy, if you understand, comes from the word Sodom, which is the city that is being destroyed by God's divine judgment. So in Sodom and Gomorrah, we have men who are displaying a citywide sin that was, first of all, unnatural because it defied the natural order of creation and especially the sexual decency of that creation. They are a perverted bunch of people. And the effect on Lot's mind, we're told in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 7 and 8, was profound. It says that he was tormented day and night over this. We find that the effect of this citywide sin was also shameless. It is open, it is public, it is indecent, and yet there is no rebuke, there is no restraint, there's no outcry from the righteous men in the city, because there are no righteous men in the city. There is no one holding anyone accountable, because everyone's doing what is being done. It is tenacious. In other words, here, after being blinded by the angels, the men are still groping after the door. They're obsessed with their sinful passion, showing you how deeply ingrained it is in them. And it is common. It is so permeated the city or the cities here that the entire population is bent on one thing, and that is their sexual gratification. That's a pretty shocking picture, even for today. I mean, we're looking at what's going on in our society today, and even today is mild compared to this. And in Genesis chapter 19, starting in verse 12, Lot is told by the angels to leave in haste. His sons-in-law think that he's joking when he tells them that. He himself hesitates. The angels urge him, though, and get him out of the city. And as soon as Lot and his family are out of the city, it says that fire and brimstone came down from heaven, wiping Sodom and Gomorrah off the face of the earth forever. And Sodom and Gomorrah's destruction is a precursor of a greater fire. In 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 6, it says that that place, that occasion, serves as, I quote, an example to those who would live ungodly lives thereafter, unquote. What Peter is saying is that what you saw in Sodom and Gomorrah in that account is what is going to happen in the future, and that those people at any given time who are going to live like those people in Sodom and Gomorrah are going to face that kind of judgment from God. Doesn't mean in this life necessarily, but they're going to face that kind of judgment from God. That's what it means. May not be the same method, in other words, but certainly the same divine vengeance, the same intensity, and yes, the same ruin. So God allows sin to be practiced only for so long and for so far, and then he destroys the source of that sin, and that would be the godless people themselves. And Sodom and Gomorrah's sin could not be ignored. It warranted judgment since mercy no longer had any effect on them. You think about that. God's mercy is not endless. We talk about, you know, your loving kindness or your mercy is everlasting. That's stated. We had a lesson on that a couple months ago, in fact, in December. And that doesn't mean that the mercy never runs out. What it means is, as long as people are responding to that mercy, there will be plenty of it, and it will never run out under those conditions. But if someone sits there and stiff-arms God and rejects his mercy and rebels against him consistently, habitually, chronically, time after time after time, God finally says, enough of that, and takes care of the situation through justice rather than grace and mercy. All right, now that we've said that, in Genesis chapter 19, verse 17 and verse 26 here, if we put these passages together, the angels had told Lot and his family there, the ones that went with him, his wife and two daughters, escape for your life, do not look behind you, do not stay anywhere in the valley, escape to the mountains or you'll be swept away. And then later it says, but his wife from behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt. Lot's wife was instructed, therefore she was not ignorant of what to do. She had the same instruction as everyone else, and she chose to defy that instruction. And she must have believed in the destruction because obviously she fled. And the question remains, well, why did she look back? And furthermore, why are we warned to remember her? And someone might even say, well, was just looking by itself a sin? And that sidesteps the real issue here or misses the point entirely. It's like saying of Adam and Eve, well, you know, eating fruit is not a sin. I don't see why God was so upset about that. Well, it wasn't just eating fruit, right? That minimizes the problem completely, misrepresents it completely. And in this present case, you know, the wife looking back, it wasn't just looking at all. It was in defiance of what she was told to do. As opposed to what we see in the attitude of Abraham himself. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 10, it says that Abraham was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. In other words, we have a very different person here. We have someone not looking to the ruin of what man has built, but rather to the permanence of what God builds. And that shows a completely different state of mind, a completely different attitude, and a completely different perspective. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 18, we're told likewise, Christians are told not to look at things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. Not at the temporary, but at the eternal, in other words. Not at the earthly, but at the heavenly. In other words, can we just say it this way? Don't look backward, but look forward instead. Keep your eyes forward. Don't look back on what you left behind. Look forward to where God is taking you. Yes. If you think about that, isn't that really what Lot's wife should have done? Instead of looking back to what she left behind, she should have just looked forward to where the angels were taking her. And thus, we welcome the destruction of those things which defy God and are not worth saving, that nearly destroyed us in the process. Now, I'd like you to read with me in Colossians chapter 3. I just think this is such a powerful passage here, one that ought to be read, quite honestly, frequently, if you want my opinion on the matter, for what it's worth. Because Colossians 3, Paul just gets to the heart of the matter here. In chapter 3 and verse 1, therefore, if you have been raised up with Christ, which refers to Christians, it cannot refer to anyone else, keep seeking the things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And he goes on to say that when Christ returns, then you who belong to Christ will be caught up to glory with him. In other words, what he's saying is we ought to be looking toward the source and direction of our salvation, and that is not the church, by the way, and that is not preachers, and that is not people, that is God himself. Really, it is Christ. He is our Savior. He is our Redeemer. The point here, though, is that just because we know where to look doesn't mean we're actually looking, or that we're not looking back from time to time, or altogether. Where we look is where our heart is. And if our heart is in heaven, then we're going to be looking in that direction. Doesn't that make sense? I mean, isn't that a practical way to look at that? You look at where your heart is, wherever you placed your heart, so to speak. If your heart is here in this world, well, it doesn't surprise me that you would be looking here in this world. If your heart really is in heaven, then it does not surprise me either that your eyes will be heavenward in their focus and in that direction. Lot's wife's longing and desire for what she was forced to leave behind was apparently so intense she could not bear to watch it. As we said, the danger was real. She knew that. She fled to save her life, but she didn't have a conviction of the heart. She forfeited her salvation, all for one look. She was unwilling to let go of the world. And isn't that the teaching that Jesus and the apostles keep giving to us over and over and over? It's not worth going back. It's not worth looking back. What you left behind was left behind for good reason. Don't look back to it with fondness, with excitement, or with longing, or with, you know, some kind of, I wish I could have that all over again. Even if she had not looked back, Lot's wife suffered great loss because Lot was a wealthy man, and as far as we understand, he lost much, if not all, of his wealth in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. But that loss is all relative to God because the loss of the things of this world are expected and necessary in order to gain more than whatever we lost in the first place. And isn't that what Jesus says? Even if you gain the whole world but lose your soul, well, you lost everything. That's not a good exchange. But if you give up your life in this world, if you give up your stake in this world, if you give up your claim in this world in order to have life with God, well, that's a good exchange. Now you're giving up something inferior for something superior, as opposed to giving up something superior for something inferior. I hope you follow that because it's so important. But to Lot's wife, who becomes this woman of the world, seduced by the lifestyle of sin, caught up possibly, very likely, in fact, in the pleasures of ungodly people, the loss of Sodom and Gomorrah was everything to her. Salvation, as it was in the case of her getting out of Sodom, meant having to leave what she loved the most. And all that she had come to know and love was going up in flames. In God's view, there was nothing worth saving. In her view, she was losing everything. I want you to just think about what's going on here and keep coming back to your own situation or to our present day situation. This world's going to be destroyed someday. God keeps telling us that. We have precursors such as this to tell us that, that God's going to destroy this world. What good is it to lay stake or lay claim to a world that is doomed for destruction? There's just no point in that. Wouldn't it be better then if we were to put our heart and our attention on the things of the future where God is? And isn't that what John says here in 1 John chapter 2? You're probably very familiar with this passage, and that's okay. Verse 15, he says, "Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life, everything that is in the world is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away, and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God lives forever." Well, which group of people do you want to be with? The ones who are doing the will of God or the ones who are stuck here in this world? I think Lot's wife's account makes this passage so much more real and relevant and, yes, even urgent to us. I hope it does anyway. And it has timeless application. There are many potential Lot's wives in the church today, I believe, who are instructed to flee. Like in, it's not in your notes, but in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 11 and 12, for example, Paul tells Timothy to flee from these things, you man of God. And the things that he's to flee from are the love of money and the pursuit of ungodliness. Godliness, all those things. That's 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 11 and 12. So we're told to flee. We're told, in essence, to flee and not look back. But we have a lot of people, apparently, who are in their fleeing pursuit of salvation, look back with fondness. You say, how do you know that? Well, you can see it happening, for one. You can see it, them making that turn backward. You can see it in their heart as manifested in their behavior. Remember, we can reverse engineer people if we want to. We can look at their fruits over time, and we can know what kind of heart they have, whether it's a good heart or a bad heart. You say, how can you do that? Because Jesus said you can know them by their fruit. And so we can look at people's fruit over time, and that's a key, over time, and how we measure that and what it looks like, and then we could tell the quality of their heart, or even the quality of our own heart, by the way. Riches and material possessions, the carefree lifestyle of this world, these are powerful and universal magnets of the heart. In Luke 17, Jesus told his disciples very explicitly, when you see Jerusalem burning, don't look back. Get out of that city, run for your lives, escape for your lives, and don't look back. Don't harbor any fondness or any sentiment for what is being burned. At the same time, don't question God's judgment on that city because it's getting what it deserved. And if you think about it, that strikes at the core. This is the point that often gets missed in all this. If God is destroying something, and you're looking back with fondness on what is being destroyed, what you're really doing is you're questioning God's decision to destroy that thing in the first place. You're basically looking back and saying, well, that I don't think it was all as bad as God said, or I think there was some redeeming value to it, or I think God might have been a little bit hasty in his decision to, you know, bring destruction down on whatever it was. And you're questioning God when you do that. And that's really what Jesus is telling his disciples. Don't question God's judgment on Jerusalem, because it deserves what it's getting. Don't question Lot and your wife. Don't question God's destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah because it's getting what it deserves. And when we are coming out of this world as we are, I'm not talking about death here. I'm talking about just in our spiritual separation from the wickedness of this world. Don't look back because what is being destroyed is ripe for destruction, and let God destroy it. Don't question him. And we're told to remove stumbling blocks and whatever causes us to sin and cast those things away from us and not look back. Whatever God has judged to be not worth saving, you must agree to that and give your consent to that and honor that decision that he has made. And that means then that whatever ungodliness or greed or self-indulgence or lust or sensuality that is characteristic of this world is destined for destruction. And therefore, let it go. Just let it go. Don't hold on to it with any fondness. Don't say, I wish I could do what those people do. Or something like, I wish I could have what those people have. Or I wish I could enjoy what those people outside of the Lord could enjoy. They look like they're having so much fun. And it just seems so exciting and so enthralling. And they're all seeming to be laughing and enjoying one another. And I wish I could. No, you don't wish you could do that, I hope. Because it's that very carnal, carnival-like atmosphere, that very godless, unspiritual atmosphere that godless people live in and thrive in, and that is what is going to be destroyed. You don't want to be sucked up into that. Whoever will not let go of the world is doomed to perish with the world. Ask Lot's wife. Now let's turn to something else here. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Let's just read a few verses here as we get ready to close. Think about what Paul is saying. Now as to the times and the epochs, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you. For you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. While they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly, like labor pains upon a woman with child, and they will not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, that the day would overtake you like a thief. For you are all sons of light and sons of day. We are not of night nor of darkness. So then, let us not sleep as others do. Let us be alert and sober. This puts things in perspective. Now he's not talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Now he is talking about the end of the world. And basically he's saying, you need to be ready for this. This is the proper perspective to have. The question is not that, whether it's the proper one or not. That's settled already. The question is, what is your perspective, and is it like this one? In Luke 17, verse 33, Jesus says, right after saying, remember Lot's wife, he says, whoever seeks to keep his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life will preserve it. Well, to lose your life is to relinquish your hold on this life so that you can have life with Christ. To keep your life means to hold on to or preserve or try to protect your life and really your own soul by your own power, and therefore relying on your strength rather than God. And as we have been saying, there's nothing here that is worth keeping and nothing here worth losing your soul over, because hopefully your soul, hopefully you realize anyway, that your soul is the most important, the most precious thing that you own. It's not your house, it's not your car, it's not even your family. The most precious thing that you own, that you personally own, is your soul. Nonetheless, while some may be convinced of God's way that it is right, they're not necessarily converted to God's way. In other words, they know it is right up here in the mind, as we've been saying, but not in the heart. They know they ought to flee from the destruction that's to come, but their heart is still firmly attached to the here and now. And such people are given opportunity for salvation, like Lot's wife, but they will be completely lost if they do not change their heart. And someone might say, but the destruction is so far off that, I'll have plenty of time. Are you certain of that? Did you read 1 Thessalonians 5, where Paul just said that it's going to come like a thief in the night? He's not saying when it's coming, but he's most certainly saying it is coming, and he's saying it's coming suddenly. What he's really saying is you need to be prepared always for that. The people of Sodom and Gomorrah never saw it coming. The people of Jerusalem who were caught up in that lifestyle never saw it coming. And I can guarantee you, because of what God says, that when the end does come of this whole world, that there will be a great mass of people who never saw it coming. And Jesus reminds us, remember Lot's wife, because this woman failed to listen, she failed to obey, and she is worthy then for as a remembrance, not of good things, but of a warning there. As a result, she was destroyed by that, and if we fail to remember, we also will be destroyed. But it doesn't have to be that way. And of all people who should be alert and sober, of all people who should know, of all people who should be ready, shouldn't it be Christians? Well, where are you? Does that passage in 1 Thessalonians 5 describe you? Are you the sons of day and children of light? Are you one of those? I hope that you're taking this seriously. We have said the same things we said this morning. If you missed this morning's lesson, well, there it is, in a different way. And so we're saying the same things, we're coming to the same conclusions, we just went about it a completely different path. If there's anyone here that needs to make their life right with the Lord, this is a great opportunity. It may be the only opportunity you have. It may be the last opportunity that you have. Why don't you do something about that tonight while you have a chance, as we stand in